The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on March 9, 2008. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Good to see you all. This morning, I thought what I'd talk about is something that caught my attention at the last Sesshin. We were doing the Blue Cliff record. We were looking at case number 10 from the Blue Cliff, and the character of the Zen master in that case is Mujo, a very interesting Zen master. And in the commentaries on this case, they cite this place where Mujo would say to his monks, he said that you must have a place to enter. If you have no place to enter, he said, then you must find a place to enter. What he's referring to is entering onto this path, this way of enlightenment, this way of awakening. And he says, if you don't have a place to enter, you must find a place to enter. This entering the path, this is the true initiation into this way of the Buddhas, those who have awakened. And so it is vital that we do this. If this is our interest, if we want to wake up, we must find this place. Sometimes we're easily distracted by one thing or another. We don't wear the robes here now, but it's so easy for us to be distracted by one thing or another. And we might think that taking up the vow of one who is ordained, who puts on these robes and practices, that this is how we might enter. But this has nothing to do with it. In fact, that could be a very dangerous thing, because many people put on these robes and then they don't carry out this practice. They don't carry out this way. They haven't found the place to enter. Dogen Zenji speaks of these people. He says that they compound their error if they do something like that. That if we're going to take up this vow, to take up this way, then you better do it. Or don't take that vow, at least. Dogen reserves great praise for those who have never taken this vow, and yet they do take up this practice in this way. And it is quite possible to find the place to enter without taking up the vow. But it is certainly helpful if we take up that vow, but then you have to carry it out, or you were in worse position than before. So this is a very critical issue. It's very important that we really understand this. But what is this place to enter that has nothing to do with whether you're lay or priest or whatever it is? What is this place to enter? Most of us, we never find this. It's very difficult. Even people who take up this vow, they don't find this. Very easy to miss. This true entering onto the path to awaken is because we're so confused about this. And this place to enter, it's kind of like to enter onto the path, it's like we come up against this wall, this mile-high wall that is not only steep, it's vertical, but it is slick, it is seamless, it is of such material that we can't even pound. If we're like a mountain climber, we pound those spikes, what are they called? You pound those into the wall to climb. Too hard. You can't pound the spike into this wall. No way to climb over this wall. And were we to walk around this place to enter, we can walk all the way around, whether it's a city wall or a mountain or whatever. Something's walled off. Something's on the other side. We can't even see it. The wall is so high. It's so high, but it is the place to enter. And we can't find any place to enter. No gate, no portal, no seam that we could break open to enter. This is how it seems for us. And so it might remain for us kind of mysterious. What's on the other side of that wall? And we don't understand. And yet we're told in this teaching and in this practice over and over again the place to enter. But it's like we don't hear it. It's thrown up there on the wall. Here's the place, see, to enter. But for most of us, it doesn't stick to the wall. We didn't hear that. We didn't find that place, even though it's pointed out to us again and again. So we're very confused about this point. And we can go on for years in our confusion and never really take this up. Because were we to once finally take this up, it won't be too long before we can actually awaken. But first we must find this place to enter. And this is what I want to talk about this morning. This is a comment that Mujo gave to his monks, that you must find this place. If you don't have a place to enter, you must find it. It's a very critical, critical point. But the reason we're confused about this kind of confusion is very much like, for all practical purposes, identical with, but it's of a different issue here. But it is very much like, say, our confusion about happiness. And don't we all want to be happy? Isn't that something desirable for us? That might even be more palpable than, say, our desire to awaken. But once we fix on that desire to awaken, maybe we start to notice, say, yes, well, but the desire to be happy, surely that is something that is right there present with most of us the moment you even just slightly turn your mind to it. Of course, I want to be happy, but we're very confused about this as well. And in exactly the same way, we're confused about this place to enter. We're confused, you know, I've talked about this before, this cartoon that I saw once, great cartoon of Hagar the Horrible. You've heard me talk about this, but where he was offered this choice by a wise man. You know, if you could choose between power, gold, or true happiness, what would you pick? And Hagar says, well, I would pick power. Because if I had power, then I could get the gold, and then I'd be truly happy. Well, of course, we might think this way. Really, that's kind of where most of us go. Because, well, gold certainly. To be rich, won't that supply me with happiness? And power, yeah, power to control. Isn't this something desirable? But these are palpable, these are graspable things. True happiness, yeah, we don't seem to know how to, well, find that place to enter into true happiness. Where is that? What is it? It's kind of an amorphous thing. It is not a distinct thing that I can just reach out and grab and take hold of. And so we look for these other things that maybe that will supply us with that. Supply us with happiness, or supply us with what, awakening? We don't understand it. You just need to walk directly to it, go right into it if you want to find that. But we get sidetracked by these things that we can grasp and take hold of. And so this is the kind of confusion that we have about this. And as I've talked about this before too, that there's a book I read a while back, I commented from it, Stumbling on Happiness. Stumbling on Happiness. Interesting book. Written by a fellow, I think he's teaches at Harvard or someplace, but a contemporary. And he's investigated this matter of happiness and how it is that most of us seem to get this wrong. We don't seem to be able to find this. And like in the case of this matter of, say, if you were rich, maybe this would supply you with happiness. Yeah, well, what he pointed out, when they've done studies on this, and he pointed out that, yes, if you're in dire poverty, yes, to increase your wealth to some degree, yeah, this might raise your level of happiness. But they noted that once basically your needs are met, you know, you have adequate food, clothing, shelter, and all, you know, the basic needs, and maybe a little more. He just said the basic needs, once they're met. Any increase in wealth that you might have beyond that point does not increase your happiness. Well, but we might think so because it seems like, well, yes, you got to have these, you know, and so we're kind of going up this curve and then we'll continue on and we think that maybe we need more. But actually, were we to pursue that very far, there might even be a slight decrease in your level of happiness. So that is not how to increase your happiness level. But if we could find this place to enter that Mujo was talking about, this place of entering onto this path of awakening, this matter of happiness could increase, not really increase, a little bit more subtle than this, but it was as if it would increase way beyond this point. That where more money isn't going to help you. But it actually changes your mind in such a way that this matter of happiness is not even really an issue. That even if your wealth and power and whatever else were to fall to zero, still have no bearing, no effect on, say, your happiness. This is the place to enter that Mujo was talking about, that we need to find. But again, our confusion is very much like the confusion that, say, Hager has. Our confusion, our basic confusion about something like happiness and what would make us happy. That very common view that we might have because we're materialistic beings. We live in a kind of materialistic culture now. Maybe this is driven into us even more, the idea that if we had more, maybe that would make me happier. Yet really, if you look very carefully, your life probably doesn't. But we are confused in this way. As I said, it's very much like the confusion that we have about this place to enter. Well, there's a story I want to tell you that might illustrate this. It might help us see this a little better. It was actually a story offered by Herodotus, you know, the ancient Greek historian, the father of history, Herodotus. And he told the story of apocryphal, to be sure, I think, because the characters involved that aren't contemporary, so these guys couldn't have met. So here's the father of... modern scholars have kind of criticized Herodotus for this because these guys couldn't possibly have met. So what kind of history is this? But Herodotus, I think, was telling this story to make another point, which won't be the point I'll be bringing up here from this story, though it's a sidebar to it, though it would actually be a whole lecture by itself, and it might be an interesting one to explore at some point. But anyway, the story is that Herodotus told is of this meeting between King Croesus, you know, Croesus, the legendary wealthy man. This is from where we get the phrase "rich as Croesus." You know, do we know that phrase? Croesus and a meeting between Croesus and Solon, the legendary man of knowledge and wisdom. And in this story that he tells, Herodotus tells, we have this meeting, and King Croesus, with all his wealth, he hears about this man Solon, this wise man, and he wants him to come to visit. Wines and dines him, brings him to dinner, perhaps. So they have their meeting, and Croesus asks Solon at some point, after, you know, a few exchanges, whatever, and then he says, "Well, tell me." He said, "Who would you say is the happiest of men?" Now here's Croesus. He's standing here in his palace, and he's got his finery, his robes, his servants, and you know it's probably very posh, so here he's standing here and asks this wise man, "Well, who would you tell me? Who would you say is the happiest of men?" And Solon throws out some obscure name, and Croesus, who are you speaking of here? And he says, "Well, this man who he was very good, and kind. People loved him. He was a very honorable man. Lived a good and decent life, and everyone loved him. And when he died, everyone felt that he had lived a life worth living, a life that everyone should emulate. And he died the happiest of all men." And so Croesus thought, okay, all right. So, well, then who's the next happiest man? And so he says, He said, well, that would be Cleobus and Byton. Who? He said, you know, Cleobus and Byton. Well, who are these guys? Well, you know, Cleobus and Byton, these are two young brothers, young men. Again, very good, kind. Everyone loved these two brothers. They were also very athletic, very strong, and handsome. Just, you know, wonderful fellows that everyone loved. And they would help others and serve others in all sorts of ways. And Solon goes on to tell this story of these two brothers who one day their mother, she was late to go to the temple. She goes to the temple of Hera, the goddess Hera. These are Greeks, you know, so she goes to the temple and to worship Hera. And this is very important to them. You see, you have to do this at the right time, in the right place, and in the right way. You know, for these ancients, it's very serious business. And his mother now was late, and she had to get there on time, and the servants hadn't yoked the oxen to the cart or whatever that would take her there. So the brothers, they put their mother in the cart, and they strapped the yokes on themselves, and they ran, you know, several miles down through the streets to carry their mother to the temple so she could get there on time to do whatever she has to do. And of course, people are seeing this demonstration going on. You know, their two brothers pulling the cart through the streets and taking their mother to the temple. And finally, when they get there, they're all just cheering and praising the mother for these two wonderful sons that she has. You know, these two wonderful boys that would do this for their mother. And of course, she's very happy and proud of her sons. And she goes into the temple, and then the two young men they go and lie down under a nice shady tree. They're exhausted from from this trip that they just took. So they lie down under a tree and they fall asleep. In the meantime, the mother's in the temple. And at some point there, just happy, you know, that all the praise, you know, that she got for her sons and how wonderful her sons are and how happy she is, you know, and proud of her sons. And so she prays to Hera then, and she said that, may my sons die the happiest of men. Well, with that, the two sons under the tree, they never again wake up. They die right there, the happiest of men, outside the temple. Well, that's the story. The point that Herodotus is making is this matter that that you have to die before it can be determined whether or not you're happy. That's another issue. But there is this matter, and it is kind of related to this matter of finding this place to enter. Because it was that these young men, they found this place to enter, and we could perhaps carry that symbolism, or well, that image perhaps I could say, of this matter of dying. In a sense, this place to enter is kind of like a dying of a certain sort. It is a dying unto the self, where most of us want to promote that and keep that right here and put that forward, this self. This is our concern. This is our preoccupation. But you see what it was with these two young men, Cleobus and Byton, they were selfless. That is why everyone loved them. That is why, without any concern, they immediately did what needed to be done to get their mother to the temple on time with no thought for themselves and how arduous and exhausting this would be. With this, we find true happiness. It always comes in just this very way. And it is in precisely this same way that we find this place to enter that Mujal was talking about. But this is what people do not understand, and this is how it is that we don't find this. This is why it is difficult for us to find true happiness. It is also difficult for us to find this way to enter and to take up this path of awakening. is because we remain occupied with ourself and our own little petty concerns, even of which where we say, well, I want to be happier, I want to be enlightened, I want to take up this path, I want to take up this way, but it is for me that I am doing with not that much concern or thought for others or for the world or for anything else, but we make this the center of our concern. Oh, yeah, and I'll take up this path and I'll put on these robes, I'll strut around and look fancy and proud and whatever. But, of course, I'm going to do this, we could say, for others, to help others, you know, so that maybe I can serve others. But that's a secondary thing. I see that even in some of our candidates here. Have this sense, yeah, they want to serve, they want to help, but in some cases it rises up more than in others, perhaps. That there's really, the real concern there is for the kind of a self-promotion there. And to whatever extent we think we're going to find happiness or peace and joy through living out of this sort of mind and forming our life and pumping energy into our life with this kind of idea and thought, we will not find it. And we certainly will not find this place to enter on the path of awakening by carrying on in that way. That we have to forget this matter of this little self here and turn our attention to what? Well, just this, which happens to be true self nature. It's just this, but it isn't you, it isn't me, it isn't any one of us in particular. We can't even find really these particulars that we might otherwise preoccupy ourselves with, especially that one here, me. So we die under this. We forget this. So see if you can set this aside. We have to at least, as I say, you know, this is pointed out to us, but it's like it's thrown up on this wall that we can't get through. We can't find the portal. We can't find our way through. It's just this solid wall. And even though it gets thrown up there, it never sticks. And we always forget. And even though we might come back and in one way or another, today I'm telling it in another way, a different story, a different way, but just in this effort maybe to, once again, to show you, this is what you need to be watching for. And you need to see it in your own heart and mind, moment by moment. Watch that. Of course we forget, but that's okay, that's pretty normal, but at some point bring yourself back and notice where you are with this and what you're doing. And what do you think you want to get out of this anyway? For you? See how that actually binds you to unhappiness and confusion. Then see if you can just forget this. It's not a matter about you. If we want to awaken, if we want to really taste true happiness, then we set this aside, we let it go. I've told this story before, one of my teachers used to tell, that this, people searching on the way, you know, they hear about this matter of enlightenment. And they want to get enlightenment as if enlightenment were something that they could grasp or take hold of, you know. And they hear about, there's this enlightenment tree, you see. This enlightenment tree that bears this fruit, and then were you to eat this fruit of this tree of enlightenment, then you would become enlightened. And so people go off searching everywhere for this tree of enlightenment. And they go here and they go there. Completely forgetting the whole message, the whole story. What was that? Well, this tree of enlightenment. Because you realize there's really no such thing. But this tree of enlightenment, this place where you would have to go, it grows on the mountain of egolessness. It grows on it. There is no other place for this, and there's no other place to approach it. There's no other place to enter. It is on this mountain of egolessness, and you cannot forget that. And you have to realize your motive in each moment, where it is you're coming from, and what it is that you want to do here. And if you want to awaken, you can't lose sight of this. And what it is you need to do about it, we think, well, once again, we'll approach it with a grasping view. Well, then, oh, I've got to take hold of something and wrestle it to the ground. What, your ego, yourself? No, you can't do that. What it is that we need to do is to realize what's motivating you, where your true heart is. Wake up to that. See that. Because enlightenment is nothing more than seeing delusion, realizing what that is. And so you don't act out of it. You don't step out into that or from that or out of it. You leave it alone altogether. And then with this, now we can begin to act in some other way. And as for that wall, the reason we can't find any door or window or fissure in the wall, whatever, we can't find some way through. The reason for this is because it isn't a matter of somehow muscling the thing to the ground or climbing over or whatever. It's just simply a matter of seeing this properly, and we walk right on through. So this is something that, once again, we don't understand. The analogy here is that we think there's something we have to struggle with. Something we have to do, something we have to figure out, something we have to explain, something we have to understand in some conceptual way. It has nothing to do with any of these things. It is simply a matter of seeing where we are and what our motive is and just what this is. And to understand that we're told over and over again that this matter of awakening, same thing with this matter of happiness really, but this matter of awakening. And if we find that, whether you're below the poverty level or not, it won't matter to you. This matter of awakening is coming back to realizing where you are and what you're doing. It is not something for you to grasp or to take hold of or to get or to acquire or to form some identity out of. It is simply a matter for you to see and to realize what that is. And then in this way, there's no wall. This is entering onto the path. Now we can begin to practice. Now we can begin to take this up and do it in the proper way. And with this comes the awakening, comes the understanding. And it is not yours. It doesn't belong to anyone. It is not some peculiar point of view that any one of us would have. It is nothing like that at all. But it is simply to be acting in this moment out of understanding and not out of some grasped view. So it is something at this point then very, very quiet when we first enter onto this path. When the wall isn't there, we just walk through. There's no barrier, nothing blocking us from this. But our own thinking, our own confusion is all that does the blocking. Were we to see through this and finally understand that, we can just walk right on through. And it is something very quiet, because there's nothing there to noise about. Nothing there really to say. And so with entry onto this path, it's a very quiet thing. But then in time, with some understanding, then we can begin to act and to speak once again. As if, what? Outside the gate, outside the wall. Outside in the world of confusion where people are confused. In other words, we act and speak very much as an ordinary person, very much in an ordinary way, using words, eating, sleeping, carrying on normal human life. But with awakening, if awakening is there, if it is with us, it is not caught up, bound up in ego. This matter of ego, does it ever arise in the mind of, you know, someone, like, is there any particular one who's really awake? Well, no, we can't really say that. But there is this thing that we can become acquainted with. We can see this little self, this little stinky person here just coming in. And if we really understand this, we will see the kind of sorrow and pain and confusion that is bound up with that. And if we're really acquainted with it, you're not going to go very far with it. There's nothing to be gained from it whatsoever. And everything is to be lost. And what is that to be lost? Our understanding of, well, beyond true happiness, of realizing what this is right here. And so in time, we can learn to speak. We can learn to say something. As my teacher used to say then, finally in the end, well, in the end, you have to say something. He says, if you don't say anything, then no one will understand. So we have to say, we have to point out. But there is this quiet time, this quiet moment when we realize really nothing to say, nothing to grasp, nothing to take hold of, nothing to form an identity out of. And this is real freedom. This is real peace and happiness and understanding. But that has to be understood. If we really want to take up this way, just forget yourself and now take it up. Might seem at first that this is an impossibility, this cannot be done. But it can. There have been plenty of examples for this well before our time to show us this. But we have to understand just what this is, otherwise we remain locked in our confusion. You have to, in this moment, see that grasping nature of self. It's not a matter of destroying it or killing it or wiping it. There's really nothing there other than an illusion. But see it for what it is and the kind of pain and sorrow that is bound with that. And realize there's nothing in it for you but the pain and the sorrow. When we really understand that, you won't go there. Or you go there and then you quickly taste it. You become familiar with it and you don't stay there. That is the place to enter. It is something like that. Well, maybe I've said enough this morning. Maybe you have a question about anything I said here? Yes.
Is it possible then to, if the ego was part of something, maybe that's an illusion, but is it impossible somehow to integrate that ego with entering on the path?
No. Strictly speaking, no. There could always be this vestige of ego, you know. But that can't be. What was it? Somewhere just recently I talked about the ego and just taking the ego out of the driver's seat. And then I said, well, you know, of course, if we put the ego in the back seat, we all know the back seat driver, you know, the ego still. So really what it is, we need to put the ego in the trunk, you know. And so it, where it can't really mouth off to us and talk and, you know, it just, you know, don't let it get the upper hand. But strictly speaking, being on the path, being awake, the ego is not a part of that. Not, you know, but immediately, this is what I was trying to talk about too, that as soon as we begin to speak once, so it's very quiet. And we begin to speak once again, and of course now something is forming. But we have to be very familiar with it and what it tastes like, what it looks like, what it feels like, because very quickly it's bound with the sorrow and the pain and the confusion. But if we're very familiar with that, we don't need to be bound up with that. And it always looks like an ego talking, because that's what we're familiar with, unless we're awake. It's hard for us to spot that. And so it always looks like the ego is talking. It seems like a self there is talking, is saying something. But where is this coming? Is this coming from some confused image of self, you know, that's doing the speaking? So speaking out of their peculiar point of view, their interests, how they would like it, their desires, you know, egoistic desires there. Yeah, it could look that way, even if it's not. Because it will have that look. And this is something really for you to know within your own mind. And for me to know within. You're watching that. You're seeing where that is. And when you recognize where that is, you just don't give it that much power. You know, you certainly get it out of the driver's seat as quickly as possible. See if you can get it into the trunk. It's just that, see, whenever we're talking, something is being pointed, something is formed. And as soon as something is formed, sure, there's grounds for ego. But we have to step back into the world. You have to, my teacher said, you have to say something. We have to come. Can't just stay in this quiet place. We step back in. But one who's truly doing this out of understanding is not back into this world, this place where we talk and exchange and all of this, with the same kind of mind. They could be. Because, but that's their business, to be watching that and to keep stepping back out of that. But then continue to talk. But of course, everything we say, we're using things are formed, we're telling stories, there's this or that. And all the possibilities for entanglements and confusion are there, right there along with it. But we continue to talk and to point out things so that people, naturally they'll take hold of one thing or another. There's one thing they said about like a Zen master. A good Zen master is likened to a thief. See, a thief who's always stealing something from you, taking something from you. And in particular, what they're most concerned about is taking whatever it is that they might have handed you. So they tell you something, you know, they tell a story, they give you this or that, and actually we've latched onto it and we're starting to frame something out of it, you know. But then the next job of the teacher then is to, they have to find a way to remove that, take that away from you. Because no, it's not that. Because we can never settle on anything. At some point we think, well then finally we'll get, you know, that's our deluded view. You finally will get to, no you won't. The enlightened view is no, you never settle anywhere on something. It's kind of like, say, like the abortion question. We have this big debate in the country. Fortunately, it's not such a hot thing in our current politics, but it's still there. Because they can just go really crazy. And I just, you know, locked down on either side and we're just tearing it, you know, and it's like one side is going to win over the other and trounce the other and whatever. This is a complex issue. Is abortion a good thing? Well, no, not really. No, abortion's not really. Then we should get rid of it. No, maybe not. That might not be, you know, not entirely perhaps. I mean, it's a complex issue. But see, we want to have it this way. This is where we tend to go. We want to get it fixed. We want to have my point of view carried through. And we want, and that's where we are. That's characteristic of the deluded view and the deluded understanding. What's characteristic of the enlightened view is that there's this turbulence here. There's this disturbance. And maybe we should carefully question these things back and forth. And maybe that's what really needs to be done, rather than thinking that somehow we what we've got to do is finally settle on something. No, we don't have to settle. Nothing is settled. This life, this world is nothing but change and flux. That is the reality of our life. But maybe within this kind of flux and change and whatever, we can learn ourselves to at least act out of awakening and not being bound up with one held, frozen particular view or another. And so it is like that. And this is why most of us never find it, because we think that it's about finally resting on something, getting hold of something, as if enlightenment were something like that even. No, it grows on this mountain of egolessness. That means nothing formed there. And nothing there for you to get. And it's not even that the object isn't formed, it's you are not formed. Once this is seen, then we can, in this very ambiguous, this very contradictory, paradoxical appearing, turbulent world, within our own mind at least, we don't need to be agonized and tossed about and torn apart and fighting and angry, and we can work in such a way that maybe we can bring ourselves back to some kind of sanity and realizing what kind of place this world is. And you're not going to frame it up. All you're going to do is cause sorrow and pain by doing that. It doesn't mean that there's nothing for us to do. There's plenty for us to do. But it isn't with the idea that finally we're going to get our way and put that through. That is not the way to do it. That is to perpetuate the hatred, the anger, the pain, the sorrow. Okay? Okay.
How to get the ego in the trunk, so to speak, without being in a position where you're pushing something away.
Yeah. You don't have to really be cruel to the ego, even though you put it in the trunk. Trunk is really, it's not really being cruel to the ego. That's the ego's proper place. The ego itself would actually be happy there. The ego is this strange beast that does everything to perpetuate its own misery. It's incredible. So out of compassion, we can help that poor beast out of its confusion by putting it in the trunk. So it can function well, like the spare tire. You know, it's got a place for it there, you know. The ego is very strange in that way. It does its best to make itself miserable, to thwart itself. That's because it's just a ball of confusion, you see. And it doesn't know where its own happiness lies. It doesn't understand any of these things. It's a very confused thing. It's a totally constructed thing too, by the way. That's why if you put it in the trunk, you haven't really injured anything, because it's just a constructed thing. But that's really its proper place. And it will actually be happier there then. So like in an enlightened person, when the ego starts showing up, it's usually pretty happy, because the enlightened person probably isn't going to let it hang around long enough to bite onto something where it starts to become miserable again, you see. So I just keep it very quiet. And then you can actually get as close to happiness as it possibly can, but the ego will never allow itself to be happy, even though that's what it seems to be preoccupied with. But it's totally confused about the issue. So we have to get it straight. And you don't let that rule. And so it's really as simple as that. Where we can really get in touch with what is it that you really want? Well, of course, what it is we really want is just simply to be awake. And these other issues of happiness or whatever else, or the agonizing issues of our society and the kind of laws and rules and things that we should have, there's a place for these, finally, in our mind. Even though they're never settled. But that's okay. So we learn to be at ease in the world as it comes up in all of its turbulence. Without the desire, we think our job is to clear the water, to make it settle, and the water's going to remain muddy. That's why we have that chant where we say, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. Nothing surpasses the boundless mind, the mind that's going to include everything. So this is the mind of awakening. But in that way, then whatever settling can occur, it will occur. But that settling occurs with it's like that wall, you see. There isn't any wall out there for you to be charging through to try to break your way through or to climb over or whatever. As long as we keep approaching it that way, it's this adamantine surface here that we can't break through. But we're just confused. Once we're no longer confused, there's no wall. You just go right on through. So it comes down to just simply our understanding and where we are with this. Are we awake or are we confused? And the way to find your way out of that is to start to recognize what the confusion is. The awake aspect of it, this never shows up as anything. That's why we keep looking for it. That's why the image of the fruit on the mountain of enlightenment is wrong. Because if there isn't any, enlightenment really isn't some particular thing. But delusion, I suppose in a sense delusion is neither, but delusion is always handing us particulars for us to grasp. And these things can be used temporarily, provisionally, in certain ways. And then we set them down, let them go. That's the time when the Zen master maybe speaks, says something, because you have to say something, but then you let it go. It becomes the thief, takes it away from you if you grab it. Yes.
Should we ever adopt the view that, not like looking for enlightenment or whatever, but should we ever think we've got it?
No. There's no getting it. There's nothing to get.
Well, I know, but we have to say something. We don't have to talk about something because.
But that talking isn't coming out of something, some gotten thing, some held thing, some held view. There's no view to get hold of. That becomes a frozen view. That just becomes an ordinary view.
Like, I sometimes think about, the religious path of all kinds, because I think it's awakening in all kinds of religions, not just Buddhism. If you're really practicing whatever it is, there's a possibility for awakening. But that I see sometimes myself and other communities wanting to get to a place where we will never ever again be tripped up. We'll never ever again feel the confusion. We'll never ever again.
Yeah, well, and as long as you make that into some hard and fast thing, some graspable, some thing out there that I have to get, you just perpetuate the very confusion and difficulty that you're trying to get yourself out of. So this is a radically different thing, a completely different approach, and it's a unique approach. It's truly unique. There's nothing else like this. This is it. It has to be done just this way. You just come here and sit down. Settle down. Notice what you're doing. That's what needs to be done. And there's no other way about it. Another way of looking at it is like we say, well, there's many roads to the truth. Yeah, well, way down here in the foothills, let's say if you got the, use another bad image perhaps of a mountain of enlightenment. And there's many ways to get to the summit. Yeah, okay. Maybe so at the beginning. But finally, when you get near the top, the options for that are few. And maybe at the last moment, there's only one way to do this. And that is just simply to come here and to sit down and to... See, we have to get clear on what it is that we're looking at here. We keep thinking we're looking at enlightenment as if enlightenment were a thing. That's why the image of the mountain doesn't work, really, in the end. But we think it's some particular thing. It's not. The particular thing is always delusion. The thing you would reach for, the thing you would grasp, the idea you would hold, it is always delusion or illusory. Our delusion comes of thinking that we can actually get hold of something in that way. So you have to recognize. So what it is that we want, well, you can't get hold of that. So then now, what can I do? Well, what you can do is notice what you're doing. Grasping this is not it. Grasp this is not it. This is not it. At some point, we finally can realize what our situation is. That is all. That you have not grasped anything there. The enlightened are not holding some particular view, holding some idea. They don't have something figured out here, so to speak, as a consequential thing. But
I was going to say, another thing that you said that really helps is me, at least, is, maybe it's some quote or something I came across, but the minute you start thinking about it, and you've lost it. It's just this, and paying attention to what is right here. And
yeah, we have to stop thinking about enlightenment. Yeah. What we have to notice is in this moment, we have to notice the delusion. That's what we can see. We can recognize that. That's what we have to forget. The enlightenment. Enlightenment is that you not only notice this, but you understand it. You realize what this is. That's what enlightenment is. Yeah, but have you grasped enlightenment? No, there's nothing there to grasp. And in seeing what the grasping is, this is none other than enlightenment itself. But in the next moment, of course, anything can form it, and we can grab it once again. But once we understand what we're doing here, we can learn now. This is what it means now, and finally to be on the path. That's why this entering is to get clear about how it is we're confused. We don't even get ourselves onto the path. But once we finally realize that, now we can begin to practice this. We can really begin to walk this way. Is there an end to this where we're finally fully accomplished? No, don't even think about this. Never mind. Just see if you can just get your feet on the path. And that's enough. Now. And now you become very familiar as well. You keep stumbling off. Okay, but just get right back on again. But this issue about finding this place to enter, this is the most critical, because this is where most people get blocked, right at the very start. So you don't even really get onto the path. Okay. Maybe we better end it here today. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.